Just about anyone who knows me also knows of my passion for inland waterways. So, no surprise that in making new acquaintances, I'm invariably asked how far my interest goes back. That's a tricky one, since my mother tells me she always suspected I was born with canal water in my veins rather than blood. But I do distinctly recall a very early school days age, when both my late father and I yearned to own an ex-army pontoon, on which we could strap an outboard engine and innocently pootle down the cut. Its charming naivety is rather laughable to imagine now, especially in view of all the regulations that would have since been brought to bear upon our ventures. But the fact that we, or rather he, could only dream of meeting the price tag of 20 quid says much about our circumstances at the time. Instead, he suggested I start a savings policy so that in 10 years hence, somewhere towards the end of my life as I saw it at that age, I could buy a boat. Which eventually I did. No fool, my dad. He imbued in me a savings habit that endured to this day, and although I neither live in a mansion nor own a tropical island, he was instrumental in helping me appreciate the value of fiscal prudence. But back to making new acquaintances. The second question is invariably, well, other than to fish, float a boat, or walk down the tow path, what else is there to do? My stock answer is quite a lot, actually. And after more than half a century of doing exactly that, I'm better informed to address the query with not a single angler, boater, or walker in sight. My appreciation of our unique inland waterways heritage has always been up there, but was focused as if by a giant magnifying glass during my term of office as an appointee of what was then, in 2012, the new Canal and River Trust, the third sector body that succeeded the old British waterways. Here, under the remarkable stewardship of a man who has since become a valued friend, I was afforded free rein to examine any elements I wished to in promoting inland waterways into the 21st century. Bearing in mind that until not so long ago, many of them were at risk of being abandoned or lost forever, the opportunity for me to liberally extol them was music to my ears, and I grabbed the score sheet with relish, eager to add my own few notes. In turn, I examined the use of technology, in particular the development of waterways apps and the internet, the promotion of art and the engagement with the local communities, plus a personal favourite of mine, hydroelectric power generation. My advocacy of this somewhat arcane aspect stemmed from an earlier involvement with a fledgling hydropower company that examined the feasibility of installing generators along the River Severn. Not the Severn Barrage, which is a totally different concept. We were looking way further inland. Our aspirations were stymied by none other than British Waterways, later the Canal and River Trust, who, as preferred bidders, were already some way ahead of us, so we accepted the inevitable and withdrew. However, I am delighted that in the interim, several hydro operations have appeared on our inland waterways, and during my stint with CRT, I was able to offer a contribution to their development from an independent perspective. The point of explaining all this is that whilst I was doing so, it helped coalesce vague misgivings I had harboured since my student days into what was to become a palpable concern. That there is a need for alternatives to fossil-fueled energy is doubted only by climate change deniers. President Donald Trump will be remembered not least for his relentless drive for unfettered fossil energy development. He is, of course, not alone. And whilst I'm being entreated to play my part by buying a reusable coffee cup and ditching my plastic drinking straw, the Chinese are reportedly financing hundreds of coal-fired power stations both at home and in other countries. Australia is not much less tarnished in its use of coal for generation, nor is India. There are many others vying for a place on the carbon footprint roll of shame, and it makes for uncomfortable reading. But let me avoid digressing into politics by instead nailing my colours to the mast in expressing how my personal loyalties lie with hydroelectricity. Such penchant is shared by my Celtic other half, who was alongside me in the power company venture, since the Scottish government, who have invested massively in this stuff, evidently think likewise. Although, in truth, they have also invested in other forms of renewables, notably wind generation, that I suspect is part of a coordinated plan to be self-sufficient, come what they see as inevitable independence. From the borderland, southern uplands northwards, the majestic backdrop is desecrated in every direction by forests of hideous rotating blades. But hey, this is progress, or so we're encouraged to believe. Hydro is up to 90% plus efficient, and whilst much of Scotland's is at high head water levels, there are low head generators, i.e. less than a couple of metres, around Europe that are still working quietly and efficiently decades after their installation. Compare and contrast with the aforementioned wind generation currently flavour of the month with our government south of the border that provides clean electricity as long as the wind blows. But just how clean exactly? The manufacture of the turbines involves massive outlay and depletion of resources for an item that at best works at less than 30% efficiency. My figures, but they're as good as the next man's, and all for a puny lifespan of around 30 years. Although a relatively new technology, there are already companies springing up who ponder what to do with the first generation of the things. Landfill for all but the small proportion of recyclable bits seems the most likely option, which surely goes some way towards defeating the object. Solar panels are equally short-term, and again use finite and increasingly rare resources for a brief lifespan, after which they must be disposed of. Again, a problem. Don't even get me started on batteries. The electric vehicle may seem a personal transport utopia, but do give a thought as to how those batteries are made in the first place, and what happens to them and their toxic legacy when they wear out, which is not very long. Then there's the nuclear option and various others that fall within the gambit of clean energy. But I'm drawing a line under all of them and their merits, or otherwise, right now, in pursuit of the wider issue that exercises me greatly. It is an issue fundamental to every single form of energy production, and I'm frankly astonished that no politician, climate change advocate, or even the scientific community has yet publicly addressed it, since it is an objective fact that has roots predating Einstein by the thick end of 50 years. It is, quite simply, the three laws of thermodynamics. If that sounds just too complicated, trust me, it's not. And although their derivations lie in lots of maths and equations, the principles are quite straightforward. The first law of thermodynamics, also known as the law of conservation of energy, states that energy cannot be destroyed. That's it. Easy peasy. Next. The second law of thermodynamics states that the thermal equilibrium of any isolated system always increases. Thus, the thermal equilibrium of our solar system, the ultimate isolated system, is constantly increasing. The third law predicts that the ultimate demise of the ever-expanding solar system, when it has finally expanded all that it can, will be by heat death, resulting in a static state of absolute zero temperature. That's cold. But that's all a few billion years down the line. A few billion years. So, let's examine what the second law predicts will happen in the meantime. The implication of the second law is reinforced by Einstein's theories of special and general relativity and his iconic E equals mc squared, in which energy and matter are interrelated but can never be destroyed. It is this law that states, and here's the nub of my concern, it is impossible to continue creating energy from matter without simultaneously producing intractable amounts of waste heat. The entire universe, including insignificant little planet Earth, is inexorably warming, And as long as we generate energy by whatever means, hydro, solar, wind, fossil fuels, nuclear, you name it, we can only add to a problem from which there is no subtraction. This puts the whole issue of how we produce the energy into the context that no matter how we produce it, the second law expressly states that our production of the energy will inevitably produce heat. At risk of sounding heretical, I contend that the build-up of CO2 in the atmosphere in this context is almost a red herring. Get rid of all the CO2 you like. However clean or dirty we may be producing energy, the ultimate consequence of producing it is more and more heat. It may be billions of years down the line, but the third law predicts what ultimately awaits us if mankind is around to witness it, which, given our penchant for messing up the planet in our way with or without the intervention of the laws of thermodynamics, seems unlikely by a long shot. Wow, that puts a bit of a different complexion on it, does it not? Please do remember, these are the laws of science. I am simply articulating them as incompetently as I can. But if my interpretation holds water, little wonder nobody has yet stood at the dispatch box and identified it as such. For minds attuned to political cycles rather than billions of years down the line, this may be understandable. But a continuing collective silence could be considered mendacious. Perhaps I am ranting at a tangent. This is, after all, just in my opinion, so others may draw different conclusions. Yet I confess to already having sought clarification by submitting my thoughts to various authorities, not least a well-known professor of such things, who is now a respected TV and radio personality. I did this some years ago before he was quite so famous, so I accept he may be now too busy with his media appearances and scientific career to be troubled by my little query. Suffice to say, I have yet to receive a response either from him or anyone else. I wonder why. Meanwhile, I note those wind turbines are being built simultaneously with dirty fossil fuel and doomsday nuclear power stations. The hydro plants are vying for attention with solar panels and batteries, and the thermal springs are pumping alongside so-called natural yet hardly carbon-neutral gas. And still, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. Phew!